Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia,
solar-topia. Started to burn many things.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia all over God's green world.
All over God's green world. Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found all over God's green world, and I am in God's dried up world, and so is my wonderful guest Paul Krasner. We're both in Southern California, where it is gray but not raining. Paul, you got gray skies out there?
Yeah, there might be a thunderstorm, but who knows?
God, do you have any Native American friends that go out and do a rain dance, for God's sakes?
No, we just have to depend upon the apple clouds.
Yeah, but how do you seed an apple cloud? Do you throw in bad information? What do you do?
I don't understand it. It's all electronic magic to me.
Yeah, right. Well, we're talking with the absolutely great, magnificent, wonderful, couldn't be better, Paul Krasner, one of the true heroes of American society, as far as I'm concerned, a great friend, a great humorist, and a great political commentator. Paul, I am just so honored and thrilled to have an hour with you. Now, we do not have backup phones today. This is totally Skype, and let's just pray to the Indian spirits, the indigenous gods, that we can do this all. But I could not pass up the opportunity to have you on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. You and I have known each other a long, long time. We date back to the, shall we say, clothing optional hippie fest at Starwood, and which has now moved to Southern Ohio. And actually, I'm going to be there again this year because it's only an hour and a half from my house. But you have ceased coming, I'm afraid. So we will be greatly sad to not have you with us. What I would love to do, if I ever got you at another festival, is to have you play exactly the violin solo that you played at Carnegie Hall when you were... How old were you when you first played at Carnegie Hall?
I was 6 years old.
My God.
But I drove my violin teacher crazy, and then I quit playing because I didn't... I was the youngest ever to perform at Carnegie Hall, but I had a technique for playing, but I didn't have the passion that I had for making people laugh. So when I started doing comedy, I just used the violin as a prop, and I used the name Paul Mall, and then that would get a laugh, and then everything went downhill after that.
Oh, did you pull up one of those cancer causing cigarettes to enhance the pun?
No, I just you know, Lenny Bruce persuaded me. He said, "Use your own name and don't use the violin." And I followed his advice.
Well, I have never seen you, and having known you all these years, I've never seen you with a violin. So I guess I can attest to that. They must have had a small violin for you to play. Is that right?
Yeah, they were like different little sizes as you grew. The size of the violins grew.
And was your violin circumcised, or did you have a Goyish violin?
It was non-denominational, actually. But okay. what happened was. That I gave it up, but about 40 years later, I knew Tom Laughlin, the guy who played Billy, what's his name?
Oh, yeah, Billy Jack.
Billy Jack, right. And I was invited to a dinner party at his home, and he was a Thomas Jefferson fan, and they had China, you know, and silverware from Jefferson. They had Thomas Jefferson recipes made. Peanut soup, I think, was the appetizer, and they had J. Thomas Jefferson's violin there.
Actual violin?
Yeah, yeah, he played. And so he asked me to play something, and I hadn't played for 40 years. So I could, you know, in Carnegie Hall, I played the Vivaldi concerto in A minor. Now, the only thing I felt that I was competent at was to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But what I did was I said that there, and then I said I dedicate this song to Thomas Jefferson's slaves.
Yes.
And there was a kind of awkward laughter among the other dinner guests. I had to say it.
You mean Tom Jefferson's slave mistress, Sally Hemings, was not invited to this this gathering?
She was no longer alive. No matter how much the shamans and Indian I tried to contact her.
Well, you'd be glad to know in that vein that I had a student where I teach in Ohio who was an African-American. Her name was Hadassah. And part of my course was to discuss your ancestry. And in the course of her discussing her ancestry, she said that she was a descendant of Thomas Jefferson. So I should have sent her to that party.
Oh, yeah, that would have been fun. But anyway, you know, I want to tell you one thing that because I mentioned Lenny Bruce. I'm writing my first novel about a contemporary Lenny Bruce because after he died, I kept thinking, what would he be saying now? What would he be thinking about this? What would his satire take place with something that was hypocritical or was something that made you think that there was a way of turning horror into humor, like a form of alchemy. And one of the things I want to have him say at one point is something that you said, and so I'm now officially asking you for permission. But you described that as long as as long as people get busted for smoking marijuana, it would be the cornerstone of a police state, and I really like that because there was a when during the Vietnam War when they were dropping napalm on kids on the other side of the globe, that was the ultimate extension of the inhumanity of putting kids behind bars for smoking a weed. And so I can't give you permission because I can't give you a credit for it because it would break the rhythm of it. But you're giving me permission now to use it, right?
Absolutely. You can have total permission. For those of you who are not familiar with Paul Krasner, you have to stick with us here. Paul is one of the great comic minds of the American culture and all of our history. He is just a brilliant guy and a great friend, and I am just really thrilled to have him for an hour here. Paul, you've known so many of the great and outlived, by God, so many of the great activists of our time, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, neither of whom is with us today, Lenny Bruce, the great comedian. Your writing has just spanned the decade. So those of you listening, you're not clear on who Paul is, just stick with us because I have never enjoyed talking with anyone more than talking with Paul Krasner. So Paul, you have more than my permission to use that citation in your novel. And I suggest if you really want to get your blood boiling, I just read an amazing book called The New Jim Crow by a professor at Ohio State, a black woman named Michelle Alexander. And she points out very, very systematically, this is a social scientist's book, that the drug war, and especially marijuana, has been used to suppress black people since Nixon brought it in. I think that Nixon, the drug war starting in 1970, of course marijuana dates back to the 30s, but when Nixon came in, he really escalated it and turned it into a drug war. I think that was Nixon's answer to the civil rights movement, frankly, to, you know, just crush the rising black consciousness and throw them all in jail for pot. She points out that blacks and whites in America smoke pot pretty much in the same ratio of their population, but the blacks are arrested at, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times as much frequency for pot as white people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was racism that started it even before Nixon, when New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia did as Nixon did. He had a commission research it, and in both cases, with LaGuardia and with Nixon, that the commission said it should be legal. And both LaGuardia and Nixon refused to carry out what the commissions that they reported, that researched it. He had them ignore what he assigned them to do.
Right. That's because the commissions, unlike those two politicians, had no formal agenda for crushing black people, suppressing a countercultural movement. And now, of course, in recent times, Paul, the whole illegalization of pot is bound up in a prison industry, and with lawyers and judges and prison guards and companies that are in the private prison business, who really just see a drug bust as a cash flow.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's tragic. But I also want to tell you that, you know, this is not the mutual admiration society, but I have been inspired by your work against nuclear testing, nuclear bombs, nuclear power. And I want to tell you that exactly 60 years ago, in 1955, when I was writing stuff for Mad Magazine, give a script to the editor, and then if they wanted to use it, they would assign it to an artist. And the first one I did was, it was assigned to Wally Wood, who ended up drawing the Disneyland Memorial Orgy.
Right now, I'm afraid some of our listeners may be too young. You have to get to everybody listening to this show. If you have never seen this changed my life. Can you describe the Disney Memorial Orgy? It's 11x17 drawing, right? Or that's what appeared in your magazine.
Oh yeah, but there's a poster now, and that was black and white, and this is In done by about 10 years ago, a former employee of Disney digitally colored it in authentic Disney colors, and your listeners can see it on my website, paulkrassner.com.
Okay, that's PaulKrassner. If you're listening in, obviously you're listening in, if you're hearing this, if you have never seen the Disney Memorial Orgy, you have to go to paulkrassner.com and take a look. It's one of the great pieces of American art. I envision it someday being on the side of a big building like a Diego Rivera mosaic. What do you think?
Well, yeah, it's a masterpiece.
It is.
But now the thing is that when I was doing stuff for Mad, there were a few things that I had pitched to them. And if it had to do with sex, if it had to do with making fun of anything that had to do with adults, it was a matter of turning it down because it was too grown up. You know, I had a plan, an idea for pros and cons of unions, and they didn't want to do that because that was too much for grown ups. And so I went to Bill Gaines, the publisher, and he said, "Well, you know, we just passed the 1.25 million subscribers, and they're for mostly teenagers and preteens, and." So they didn't want to have anything for mature people. And I said, I guess you don't want to change horses in midstream. And Bill Gaines said, "Not when a horse has a rocket up its ass." And that was a turning point in my life, because there was no satirical article, a magazine in the United States for satire. This was before Spy Magazine. It was before National Lampoon. It was before Saturday Night Live. It was before Doonesbury. There was nothing like that for adults. Where other countries, Oz Magazine, I think, was published in Australia. Crocodile was published in Russia. In England, they had, what was the name of it?
Private Eye, maybe.
Huh?
Private Parts.
That's...
That's different.
Punch Magazine they had.
Oh, yeah, Punch. I remember Punch.
And so it was just lacking in this country.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I wanted to do in MAD was have a thing about making fun of the and criticizing the use of hydrogen bomb testing. And so in the very first issue of in 1958, 3 years later, in the very first issue, I had a thing called in Mad Magazine style, about the telethon in the form of leukemia. It was a telethon to get rid of leukemia, which was caused by the fallout of nuclear testing. And so it goes back that far.
Wow. So, Paul, are you first of all, I have to ask you, when you were 6 years old playing the violin at Carnegie Hall, were you stoned?
At 6 years old?
Well, I just wanted to check. I wanted to make sure.
In a way, I was definitely, because I woke up on the stage while playing, because I had practiced myself out of my childhood, and I had an itch in my left leg, and I was enough of a professional to know subconsciously that a professional violinist does not stop in the middle of the Vivaldi concerto and scratch the leg with the bow. And so my subconscious, was busy trying to figure out how, because the itch got more and more fierce. It became an adversary. And so what popped up from my subconscious was the image of my standing on my left leg alone, balancing on my leg, and scratching it with my right foot without missing a note of the Vivaldi concerto. And I woke up to the sound of laughter in the audience, because I wasn't trying to make them laugh. I was just trying to solve my physical problem. And I knew that laughter made you feel good. And because it had happened, if I did something at home that my mother was mad about, if I could make her laugh, everything would be okay. And so I just wanted to make a whole audience laugh at the same time. That was very gratifying. It was like a symphony, because people had different laughs. They, there were some that were like trombones, other was like flutes, and it was like a little symphony to me. And at the age of six, I really did wake up. So I had the innocence of a newborn baby with the sophistication of a six-year-old, and so I learned. A year later, when I was seven, I went to see my first movie, and that was Intermezzo. With a black and white movie, and it was Ingrid Bergman's first movie too, and she was a violin student who had a crush on her violin teacher, which I think was played by an actor named Paul Henried or something like that. But
it would be Paul Henried. He was the guy who played across from her in Casablanca. He's the guy who led the band in the Marseillaise.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That gives it a fantastic sense of continuity.
Uh-huh.
And so every time that she would walk into the room or he would walk into the room, the theme of Intermezzo would play. And and I loved that melody. And I truly, you know, it was like a secret friend. I would hum it to myself, just trying to understand the mystery of why this different notes in a different rhythm and different tones, that why it made you feel good in your heart, you know. It was and so I next time I went to my violin lesson, I told the teacher that I wanted to learn how to play intermezzo, and he said, "That's not right for you." And it was like thunder and lightning, and it sticks with me because I realized at that age that it had nothing to do with me, that that people wanted to put, you know, how did he know what was right for me or not, you know? And so I realized that people really tried to control you. Adults did with kids, you know, they wanted to control them, so it changed my attitude towards other people, and I could see where, you know, they were control freaks, and I was a practicing anarchist without knowing any vocabulary to describe it.
At the age of seven. So are you telling me that when you were 6 years old, standing in Carnegie Hall on the stage all by yourself, or I guess you had a backup orchestra or something?
No, it was a solo.
Oh, it was a solo. So it was just you on the stage of Carnegie Hall?
That's right.
Oh, my God. And you're standing there at 6 years old, and the place is full, right? And you,
yeah.
And in the middle of your Verdi concerto, you stand on one leg and scratch your leg with your other foot. What a great image that is. No wonder you're...
And so I drove my violin teacher crazy, and he died. When he died, I put my violin into the closet and left it alone. Didn't play anymore, except I would see sometimes in the New York subway when beggars would go through it, maybe with a seeing eye dog, and they would have like a tin cup attached to the dog's collar, and they would play or sing. And people would drop coins in the tin can they had there. And so that's what I decided to do. I took my mother's enamel little cup that she made for measuring stuff and put it around my belt and went through the subway, and I would play the Mendelssohn concerto. People put folded bills in there. I got several money. Several bills of money, and so I went and I bought. First, I bought some vanilla fudge with walnuts and potato chips, and I ate them. And it was like, remember Clark Bar candies?
Yeah.
And I bought that, and I still remember it was the first candy bar that simultaneously gave you a cavity and filled it in. And then I bought the sheet music to Intermezzo, and I played it for my parents, and that was it. I gave it up, I was the class clown. There was a kid who exposed himself to the class one time, and the teacher caught him, and he got sent to reform school. And I thought, well, you know, he didn't hurt anybody. Why was he being punished? So that night, I assigned myself some homework, and I drew a picture of my penis, which I held in one hand for the model, and the other hand I drew it. And the next morning in school, the teacher was out on some errand, and I stood up, unzipped my fly, and revealed – a picture of my penis. And
how old are you at the time?
I was then. I must have been about seven. I think I was still about seven then. And this was in elementary school. And you know, it was too bizarre. You know, because it was only a picture; it was not the real flesh. And and that made the class laugh. And so I was hooked. You know, the one in Carnegie Hall, the laugh was free. The first laugh was free, and then and I got hooked on it.
Wow. So, Paul, you wrote for Mad Magazine, and I'm going to, you know, John Lennon and Yoko Ono were friends of yours. They helped fund your magazine, The Realist, and you worked with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. You, I guess, came up with the phrase yippies, and I was a yippie in the streets of Chicago in 1968. You did this, it was your conception, I guess, to coin a phrase, to do this Disney orgy. And I will have to describe that it's basically all the great Disney characters from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to Pluto and Mickey and Minnie engaged in various sexual activities. People, you might want to look at it at paulkrasner.com. You sold many thousands of that poster, right?
About a couple of thousand, yeah.
So, and it's still available.
Yeah, but this is a much 18x24 on really good paper, and people get it. They don't have to frame it, but a lot of people have framed it. But it was and it also has my books, some of my books there too.
Okay. And you call yourself an investigative satirist, and you also ran one of the ultimate classic stories in The Realist of how to describe it, Lyndon Johnson abusing the corpse of John Kennedy, which I actually drew the line, I think, in the entire counterculture, people coming down on one side or the other of that one as to whether it was admissible, politically acceptable satire. Describe the reaction if you're game for it to running that story.
Right. I even though this is a progressive station, I can't use four-letter words, right?
I don't think so.
Okay, all right. Well,
flee.
What happened was in 1960.
Wait, Paul.
Yes.
I was just informed over Skype that you can use four-letter words. So go ahead. This is a podcast.
Oh, okay. What happened was that in
we are not subject to FCC. That's a three-letter word. So go right ahead.
That's right. It started with a book by William Manchester called The Death of a President.
Oh, right.
It was about the assassination. And
it was in excruciating detail, hundreds of pages of the description of the killing of Kennedy.
Right, and it was done with, it was authorized by Jackie Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, and so there were some things in it that she wanted to be deleted from it before it was published, and I was against censorship, and so I tried my best to get a copy of the original one. But I couldn't get it from the publisher. There was no way of getting that, so I was forced to write it myself, the parts left out of the Kennedy book. And it started out, I didn't even know, but it was a form of literature called apocryphal, and it means that it was made to look real, even though it was made up. And so I started out it was like an onion, starting off with the outside peels and peeling each one off. So the first layer of onion skin was stuff that was true, which was that Lyndon Johnson was the vice president, but when he lost in the primary for president, he tried to lower JFK's by family his fa- and said that, which was true, that his father was a Nazi sympathizer when he was an ambassador to Germany, and then I would take stuff that reporters knew to be true, like that Kennedy was having an affair with Marilyn Monroe, but none of the media would publish that, and then it's all led up to the climactic moment. It was like a seduction. People believed this, and then it ended up with one of the parts left out was Jackie Kennedy, was Manchester writing about what happened on Air Force One when Kennedy's corpse was being delivered to I think it was Dallas
Dallas.
They went to the hospital. Forget the name of the hospital, but anyway, Manchester supposedly described Jackie Kennedy went into where the corpse was, and it might have been in a casket already, he was leaning. JFK was corpse. It was LBJ was leaning over the casket, and at first, Jackie Kennedy thought that it was some ritual that he did, that he knew as when he used to teach Mexican kids. But then she saw, and she said to Manchester, "There's only one thing to put this, which was that Lyndon Johnson was fucking my husband in the throat wound in order to make the bullet hole from the grassy knoll so that it would look like an exit wound. That whoever shot him, that it would make it, it would change it to look like it came from the from where Lee Harvey Oswald was standing up there. So that it was made to fool the Warren Commission, and people were absolutely out of their mind when they read that because it was a total shock to them, and many of them believed it.
Well, I would have to say, Paul Krasner, that probably, and I read it, I read that story when it first came out in the Realist, and I would have to say, in the history of the entire counterculture, there's probably no more polarizing story that was ever run in a magazine of satire than that one.
Oh, I got death threats for that, and other people, they believed it for just a moment, you know, and then they realized that they had been had, because I did not label anything in the magazine as investigative journalism or satire because I didn't want to deprive the readers of discerning for themselves whether something was literally true or a satirical extension of what was a metaphorical truth, and that was in 1967. I still hear it's what people like George Carlin and Lewis Black, their minds were blown and it changed their lives. A lot of people said it woke them up. That was because they understood that for that moment that they believed it to be true was that Lyndon Johnson, the leader of the Western world, was crazy. I mean, I don't mean to insult the necrophiliac liberation front, but there are I mean, there was a lot of necrophilia going on, but that they never talked about that. But and there were, you know, you could have there were necrophiliacs who were monogamous. They would just stick with one corpse, whereas there were others who would jump from casket to gasket. They were promiscuous.
Well, so, we're talking about Paul Krasner here. The publisher of The Realist, the first really adult satirical magazine. And, Paul, you were you had the amazing ability to be both satirical and humorous as well as very political. And you were the one who, in this era of the 1960s, invented the term yippies. How did that come about at the Chicago Convention? I had a button on my jacket that said yippie, and this, of course, was a major cross-pollination, I guess, between the political anti-war movement and the cultural hippie movement.
Yeah, that I just made up a name for a phenomenon that had already existed, which was that there were stoned hippies and there were straight politicos, and but they kind of intermingled at civil rights demonstrations and anti-war protests, and there was like a hybridization that occurred in that process. Because at first they were adversaries, and the straight politicos would think, "Oh, these guys they just get stoned in the park, and they're not." And then they realized that putting anybody in prison for, as Lenny Bruce called it, for smoking flowers. That dropping napalm on kids on the other side of the globe, that it was the ultimate logical extension of the dehumanization of kids behind bars and kids being burned with napalm, and so the straight politicos realized that that smoking pot in the park was an act of civil disability,
disobedience. Civil disobedience.
Civil disobedience. Yeah, and the stoned hippies thought that there was. They learned more about who was behind the war and why it was going, and that it was, and if they were being, if they was, you know, peace and love, that they had to do something about it, and so this was the phenomenon that I knew had to have. So in 1967 in December, Abbie Hoffman and his wife Anita and I. Took a work vacation in Florida, in the Florida Keys, and we went to we took some acid, 300 micrograms for those who, and it was Owsley acid, which was 300 micrograms, and in case anybody likes to know brand names, and. And so we took those tabs there, and we were going to see Abby's favorite movie, which was The Professionals, which was with Kirk Douglas and the guy who played Elmer Gantry.
Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster. And they were two professionals who – professional revolutionists, and that was Abby's favorite. But there was a hurricane in process, and we decided to just go to a nearby movie, which was the De Laurentiis version of the Bible. And so coming back, you know, Abby and I talked about religion more than politics at that moment, and I was saying, you know, where Abraham. Because God told him to stab his, behead his kid, whatever it was, Isaac, yeah. to kill him with a knife, and I said to Abby, you know, I consider that to be blind obedience. And Abby said, no, it's revolutionary trust. And then we got back to the place where we were staying, and the hurricane was really now. We opened the window, and Abby started yelling to Fidel Castro 90 miles away to listen to this radio station that he could hear in Florida. It had good rock music. And there were papers flying around in our room there. And we had just a little black and white TV set there. But to us, it looked like orange and blue. Excuse me, I was thinking of Netflix. And Lyndon Johnson was speaking. But it was four heads, you know, the South Dakota sculptures, gigantic sculptures of these four presidents. But now Lyndon Johnson's head was speaking from one of those sculptures, and the other presidents were snickering at him. And because he was saying things like, we're not going to give up our half of the war. That would be Putin headed. And so we realized, you know, we had to go to Chicago in 68, where the Democratic Convention was going to be held. I mean, the Vietnam War was bipartisan, but as this just happened to be at under the Democratic Party, they're under their watch. And as a journalist, I knew that there had to be a who for the who, what, where, when, and why for the lead paragraph of a reporter. And so I was having a brainstorm, and I walked into their bedroom to try and concentrate on what would work as a name. I knew that if I could find, you know, I was thinking of the Youth International KIF or something like that, because it would be the acronym would be KIF for but that sounded too contrived. It was like a form of cannabis in some way. And I started figuring out, I was going through the alphabet, trying to think. And when I came to YIP, I thought that would work, because then that would be the acronym for the slang of it, which would be Yippies. And Yippies was a shout of joy. And YIP stood for Y. Could be for youth, because there was a generation gap there. I, because international, because this was a global evolutionary jump in consciousness. It wasn't just in America, and it was international. You know, these rebellions were going on in Czechoslovakia, in Paris, in Mexico, simultaneously. And the P was for party, you know, for youth international party, like a political party, and it also meant a party, and because as Phil Oakes, this folk singer who was one of the original founders of the Yippies, was he summed it up. He said, a demonstration should turn you on, not turn you off. And so, so that night, I took a walk. We didn't have a telephone there, and it was before cell phones. I took a walk into town, and to a phone booth, and I called Dick Gregory, who was in Cargo. He was in Chicago, and he thought it was
Dick Gregory was one of the great black comedians of our generation, and also a very dedicated social activist.
Right, and he was going to run for president in 1968, and he asked me if I thought that it would be a good idea to have Bob Dylan as his running mate, and I guaranteed him that Dylan would never do anything, to, you know, running for election for with the electoral college or anything, even though it would be great to have him there. And so he took on instead, it was Mark somebody, one of the first.
Mark Wayne.
Mark Lane,
who was one of the lawyers who wrote about the conspiracy to kill Kennedy.
Right. He was one of the first to do that. And so he was going to be his running mate as vice president. And then I called up Jerry Rubin. And, you know, then you could – you didn't have to have a round trip. You could come back at any – you had a round trip, but it didn't have to have a specific date. And so I called up and said can you set up a meeting that we'll have? Abby and Anita said they would do it in their apartment on the Lower East Side. And there were a bunch of activist friends. Could he set up a meeting there to discuss what we would do in Chicago? And so on December 31st, the afternoon of New Year's Eve, on December 31st, 1967, we had the meeting there in the afternoon. One of them brought some Columbia marijuana, and we smoked that. And so I went, when I had this brainstorm, I went back out and into the living room where everybody was talking. And we had been talking about what we would do there. We would have rock and roll bands playing instead of these dull political pandering speeches. And we would have around the perimeter of a field that we hope we could get permits for. That there will be booths, you know, with information about the draft, information about drugs, and I came out and told him what I thought the name should be, and Jerry was a little bit hesitant. Jerry Rubin was the left brain of the main two Yippie leaders, and Jerry Rubin was the right lobe of the brain, which was the left brain of Jerry was like calculating and, you know, intellectualizing stuff, and Abby with the right lobe of his brain was spontaneous and you know, Abby was he could have been a comedian if he wanted to. He was really very funny with smart wit Whereas Jerry, before he went out to make a speech, he would listen to Lenny Bruce albums to inspire him. Jerry at first said, "Well, the Yippie, I don't know." And Abby said, "No, that'd be great." And so we held two press conferences. One was for the underground press. And Liberation News Service and United UPS was United Press
Syndicate,
right? And we had announced it there, and then we had the publicist for Judy Collins had arranged for her to announce her new album then. This was going to be at the Americana Hotel, and then they arranged for us to follow her with all these reporters there. And I remember at one point, a reporter asked me, "Well, why don't you go behind the Eugene McCarthy, the peace candidate?" And I said, "Well, you know, Allen Ginsberg was there," and I said, "Well, Allen Ginsberg he would have to shave his beard and get a haircut because they were known as the Clean for Gene, and they wouldn't allow him to go from door to door." And the reporter said to me, "Well, are you, would you let your hair grow? I mean, sorry, would you cut your hair if it would help end the Vietnam War?" And before I could answer, Allen Ginsberg stood up and said to the reporter, he asked the reporter first, would you cut your hair if would you let your hair grow if it would help? And when the press conference was over, we went into the corridors of this hotel, and another of the original founders was Ed Sanders of the Fugs, which was the euphemism that Norman Mailer used in his first novel, The Naked and the Dead, where he used the word "fug" that he made up, and the Fugs got their name from that euphemism. And so so Ed said he was going to change their schedule of the Fugs and just try to organize bands. And so the thing began to grow.
Right, and it became a huge deal. Paul, we're actually down to about 5 minutes. I want to remember that I wanted you to mention how after the Chicago convention, when everybody got busted and beat up and arrested and abused, you testified at one of the most high-profile criminal proceedings in the history of the United States under the influence of LSD. Of course, if you can describe it, you weren't there, I guess, but you did in fact sit in front of a judge named Hoffman and a defendant named Hoffman, tripping your brains out on LSD. Have you come down yet from that trip?
I remember it because it was I knew I was I had to do it, you know. I was the thing was that what happened was it was starting to peak when I was in the witness room, and Tom Hayden and Jerry Rubin came in to just as it was peaking and to bring me into the courtroom, and everything was like great. It was like furniture was dancing, and all things were in different colors. And I thought Tom and Jerry. I thought I was in the middle of a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Well, you were in the middle of a Looney Tunes cartoon.
It was. And so
and
when
you
I
go.
And so when the bailiff said, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God," I said no. And the only one whoever else did that was G. Gordon Liddy, but. I said, you know, I said that, and all the heads turned towards me, you know, and the artists and the jury and everybody, and I even looked at myself and said, and there was a core of reality, and I that popped to my surface, and I said, I choose to affirm, which I learned in a civics class, that was the First Amendment. You didn't have to swear on the Bible, and so the judge said, in effect. Let him go and use the goddamn Constitution. He didn't say it like that, but that's what he said.
Right. And Paul Pleasant, you know what? Finish real quick, can you?
Okay.
No, finish. Just finish the story.
And so I affirmed, but they were asking me questions, and I was getting more and more tripping. And at one point, they said, "Now, where did this meeting take place?" And I couldn't think of the word Chicago. And I said, right here, right in this city here. And Abby was there kind of mouthing, putting his hands and saying, Chicago. And the bailiff went to him as if to say, no coaching from the audience. It didn't last long because
– So tell me, just to finish up, Paul, I could talk to you for hours. Which was more fun, scratching your leg in front of Carnegie Hall at the age of 6 or taking LSD in front of the world at your trial at the Chicago conspiracy?
Oh, well, it was the same process. I was by taking acid while testifying, I was just scratching my itch.
There you go. Paul Krasner, I could go on for you with hours. I'll have to have you back for another show, Paul.
Anytime.
This has been,
it's a delight talking to you.
This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you to the crew in New York. You've been operating under extremely difficult circumstances, and we pulled off a great show. I'm really thrilled. This has been Harvey Wasserman with Paul Krasner, the truly great Paul Krasner. Go to paulkrasner.com. Look at the Disney Memorial Sex Orgy, among other things. And we'll be back next week with another great show from Solartopia. And take it out there, Pete Seeger, please, along with Dar Williams and David Burns. This has been you on the air from Solartopia.
Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia.